Death, the Ultimate Orgasm. No, I'm not being silly. That's the title of a book just published in Australia. It collects stories of people who've died and come back, and some who say they rather enjoy the experience. Can't say I did, but more of that anon. The author is someone you may well know, but in a different guise, that of an athlete. Mike Agostini was a sprinter, but now he's a storyteller, and came to death via trying to write something else.
One of the key characters, integral to this book that I've been writing for 50 or so years, I wanted a reason why he would change his life completely. And I thought immediately of Somerset Maugham and The Razor's Edge. But I decided that I couldn't completely plagiarize Maugham, and I thought, well, a near-death experience would be worthwhile. Coming from a place like Trinidad and the West Indies, were acutely aware of those things, and having had something somewhat like it, I was once quite ill with double lobar pneumonia and felt like I was out of my body, I thought, this could make someone change their lives completely. And I decided that I'd do a little bit of research, and within virtually a few days of that, I went to a memorial service for the late Andrew Gibbons, the great real estate man who I knew when he was Andy Gibbons in Melbourne. And at that service, the Reverend Barry Burgess, a retired minister just filling in at St. Mark's at the time, just pulled a rabbit out of a hat. He said, there's a story I'd like to tell, just for no reason other than that some may find it interesting. And he talked about someone whom he knew, who was a friend, not a parishioner, only came to church for the usual reasons, weddings, christenings, and funerals, and one evening ended up in the emergency ward of St. Vincent's. He was dead. He had a massive coronary. He was resuscitated and revived. And Barry said, and when I went to see him in hospital about a week or so later as he was recovering, he sat up in bed, grabbed my arm, and he said, Barry, there's something out there and someone. And he said this from an atheist was quite amazing. And he said, he still doesn't come to church, but he changed his life completely. And from that, I decided I'd start speaking to as many people as I could. I opened up a Pandora's box.
Yes, indeed, I can imagine.
And even more so now, since this book has been out and I've appeared here and there in the media, people are actually stopping me and saying, I'm so glad you did this. And I say, why? And they say, because now I can tell about mine.
It's making it almost respectable.
Look, we live in a world in which nudity is acceptable. There's nothing more filthy than war. And all of these we can see in our living rooms. All of these things are fine, and it's about time that we dealt with death openly and looked upon it in a manner that we can say, hey, it's not as bad as we think it is.
Well, before we do so and take some more examples, just a little about yourself. You're, of course, famous as an Australian athlete.
West Indian.
Well, West Indian Australian. Do you still run?
No, I would love to run. I'd spent most of my life running. I represented Trinidad in the Olympics in Melbourne in 1956. I represented Canada in 1950 at the Commonwealth Games, which I'd won in 54 for Trinidad and Tobago. And I represented Australia in 59 and 60. Have shoes, will run. I would have been the perfect professional, but we didn't have those in those days. No, I don't run. My knees are no good. My back's no good. And having started the jogging movement in 30-something years ago, that's why people like yourself probably took it up, I then discovered as I approached 50 that my body wasn't liking it very much. And the literature was coming out quite clearly. You don't have to jog, but you can if you want to.
You can do other things. But what about your medical expertise? You know a lot about the body.
I'm a practicing hypochondriac of note. Now that I'm writing what I'm writing, I prefer to take the position that maybe in one of my many previous lives I was some kind of a physician of some sort. But no, I've always had an interest in medicine. And then, of course, being an athlete, you need to know about the human body. You need to know physiology.
Yes.
And athletes are notoriously hypochondriacal. I have never had a headache. It's always been a brain tumor. I have never had a stomach ache. It's always been cancer of the something. Males are also hypochondriacal, and now as a writer, I'm totally hypochondriacal. Therefore, you learn to study these things, and the habit has kept with me. In fact, in many an instance, I've had people say to me, and what's your specialty, doctor?
Well, I must say you look pretty damn fit, but back to death, could you tell me about the man who attended his own funeral?
Yes, that's Ron Chambers. Ron was a very well-known educator. He founded Coast Grammar School. I didn't know Ron, but I knew his son, John, who was at Sydney University with my eldest son, and through him I met Mrs. Chambers, Margaret. And Margaret told me the story, that at Ron's funeral, something happened. She didn't see it. that at the wake afterwards, she saw three of his very old friends talking and laughing animatedly, and when she walked up to them, they suddenly stopped, and she wondered what it was, and two or three days later, one of them said to her, "Can I tell you why we were laughing at the wake?" And she said, "Yes." So, "Well, actually, we saw Ron there." And she said, "I have no problem with that, because I've had experiences of the kind myself." And they said that there was a schoolboy from the Coates Grammar who had come in late, and Ron was remonstrating with the schoolboy. And while one of the eulogies was being spoken, they said, "There was Ron sitting on top of the crucifix." Now, Margaret is a very sound, sane, erudite, sensible person. And then she subsequently told a story about, they live on the central coast, just outside of Gosford, and she had been collecting the garbage down a steep hill and back up the steep hill, and she was absolutely exhausted not too long after the funeral. And suddenly she felt a presence, and she knew it was Ron. And she said, "I was able to run back up the hill and almost do somersaults." And she said, "I don't have a problem with any of those things." And that's what is delightful about this, is that there's so many people who will begin to tell their stories. And I'll leave that to the James Randis and the Richard Dawkins and the
skeptics.
The skeptics.
Yeah, sure. What about your own skepticism? What do you think of that story?
Because I present myself now not as a journalist or commentator, reporter, but as a storyteller. And that's a very easy thing to hide behind, but I must do that because there's no way of being an expert on this without becoming someone or something religious. And I don't think I'd fit very, very well into a gown. My position says that my own experiences as a young person, particularly growing up in Trinidad Tobago, being raised by Irish missionary Roman Catholic priests, it was easy to accept. Then my later education, senior Cambridge high schools, and then American university education washes it all out of you. But then having seen as much as I have, and also getting to the stage, I'm now 69, the biblical 70, and saying, well, that must be the next big event, is death. Let us look at it.
So you're hedging your bets in many ways.
My own attitude is, there is something there. I don't have a problem with it. I refuse to believe that the only existence can be in this one dimension in which we live. And when I read or try to read Stephen Hawking, who says there are at least 11 dimensions, and Paul Davies with all of his many other worlds, how do we know which world we're in?
Oh, sure. Anything is possible. On the other hand, we experience just a few, and we have to depend on what is explicable and what there's evidence. And one of the very interesting things about near-death experience, which I found fascinating, is the idea that you need to have a certain amount of energy or oxygen, really, to have a sense of self. Now, I remember the last time I, in fact, died three times in one.
You're one of my heroes.
Well, which means I came three times, so we don't want to take this too further. However, on the last one, I remember seeing, and this is typical of the near-death experience as explained in this energy self theory, I simply saw a set of images as if they were floating in front of me without my being there as an observer as such. And it was only gradually that I came back and I could actually have a person, me, associated with these visions, in other words, people looking down. Now, the idea is that when you have a near-death experience, you have less oxygen, you have less energy, and you don't have enough, if you like, grunt to make that sense of self. And so what you have instead are free-floating images. And so you have the feeling of floating above your body, sometimes looking at the cupboard that's in the next room or whatever. Have you come across, obviously you have come across that sort of idea. Obviously. What do you think of it?
We're into the realm, the areas where Dawkins, Richard Dawkins in particular, writes a lot about, and he's a great skeptic. What I find fascinating about Professor Dawkins is that he's been married five times, meaning he's been seeking love, which is quite similar.
Now he's married to someone from Doctor Who.
Is that right?
Yes, it is. Lala Ward, who played Doctor's assistants.
Is that right? Well, I dare say that certainly there has to be a chemical basis, but everything is chemical. When you fall in love, it's chemical. When you have that other word in the title of the book, an orgasm, it's chemical. When you drink the cup of tea or coffee that you're drinking right now, it's chemical. Therefore, the reality in which, this is my perception as a storyteller, not as a scientist, I'm none of those, therefore, everything must have a chemical basis for us to experience it again in this realm. And we're now talking about time and space and matter. I'm not prepared to delve too deeply into that, otherwise I might become an expert like I was once supposed to be on running. I prefer to be a storyteller because these stories, to me, equate with love stories. And the same thing they equate with, for instance, in sport. You've always heard the story of Hitler walking out on Jesse Owens, correct?
Yes.
Never happened. Isn't it marvelous?
Or the Berlin Olympics, it never happened in 1936?
It never happened in the Berlin Olympics. I was a very close friend of Jesse's, I'm proud to say. And on the day that Hitler walked out, Jesse hadn't won a gold medal on that day. But some enterprising reporter, storyteller perhaps, decided he would link Hitler's walkout to the Aryan attitude towards the black brigades of America. And it stuck.
Yes, but the explanation I gave you about near-death experience shows you what might be going on and giving a physical explanation, which is something that makes sense, rather than another worldly one that unexplains, as Asimov used to say, Isaac Asimov, all the other things you kind of know about living.
Well, Robin, once again, the question that I must always pose is, does it have to make sense? Because sometimes what makes sense doesn't make sense, if you know what I mean. Look at the world today. Look at the people running the world and look at what happens. Look at the WMD. It doesn't make sense, but we still accept it. And therefore, I'm able to play with any of these things rather than to play where you are, which is in the scientific realm, because then we have to go back to Copernicus, Galileo, and all of the other people, Newton included. And as you wouldn't well know, Sir Isaac Newton's greatest interest was in alchemy.
Oh, absolutely. He wrote more on alchemy and indeed about God than
most
he did
people
about
don't
physics.
Know that.
Tell me Kerry Packer's story.
Well, I brought that in because Tony Staley, who gave the idea for the title, Tony Staley, the former head of the Liberal Party and minister, he died three times after an accident, automobile accident, and said it was the most incredibly delightful, joyful, pleasant series of sensations. And he said the love, the joy, the compassion were beyond anything, better than anything on earth, and that gave me the idea. And then he also said that he hadn't become religious before or since, and he thought if he'd stayed in that state, he would have ended up like Kerry. So I picked up Kerry's story, and he died for 8 minutes. And as you would well know, you're supposed to be clinically dead completely.
Cactus, yes.
But he was somehow resuscitated and revived, and someone visited him in hospital and asked what it was like, and he said, "Old son, I'm going to tell you something. There's not a so-and-so thing out there but total blackness and oblivion." To which I then thought about my early religious education, and I brought in Matthew chapter and verse where Jesus is quoted as saying it would be easier for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter into the kingdom of God. But of course you've had one of those yourself where you knew nothing, and I've subsequently been informed, I need to follow it up, that in the Buddhist belief this is a higher state of soul development. So maybe you're in the same realms with Kerry, and as you know, there supposedly are seven levels.
Yes, interesting. Now, I died three times, supposedly, and I think the middle time was 47 seconds, a flat line.
Wow.
And nowhere near as long as Kerry Packer, but I had no feeling of orgasm, as Tony Staley implied, right, which is where you got your title from, just blank. I wonder how many people of the many, many, many stories that you tell, how many similarly describe this ecstasy that they associate with dying?
Particularly the drowning ones. I've got a guy, Peter Smith, he drowned when he was seven in Guatemala Lagoon. He slipped into a pothole, and he said while he struggled and fought for air, it was terrible. But once he let the water come in, he said it was absolutely fabulous, incredible. He said he didn't want to come back. And there's another guy, Michael Pohl, he's a groundsman at Trumper Park, and Michael drowned when he was 15. He said that once he let the water come in and he sank to the bottom, he felt of what it would be like to be a clump of seaweed just moving with the tide, and it was absolutely fabulous. And he said somehow he found himself above the water, on the top of the waves again, sputtering for air and feeling terrible and thinking, God, I wish I could be like that. And subsequently, a guy I know who works around the area where I live, he drowned when he was about 12. And his way of saying it, he said, if I could find the so-and-so who pulled me out, I'd kill him. And Peter Smith said, at the end of his interview, he said, mate, I'll tell you this. If someone has to die, I recommend they try drowning. Now, if you think about that, we are born in fluid, and there may be some relationship. I wouldn't pretend to know.
Yes.
And I've been told, I didn't speak to Tim, didn't get a chance, Tim Bristow before he died, but I've been told that Tim Bristow has said, many people he's rescued have said, drowning is fabulous once you get past that difficult stage. There's an area in this that may relate to jogging, if I can bring this in. During the jogging boom in America, leading physician in America came out publicly in all the media. He said, look, this is a terrible pastime. How could they really be enjoying it? They puff, they pant, they grunt, they groan, they perspire, and they grimace and make terrible faces, and yet still they say it's joyful. And the head of the American Medical Association on jogging, the only medical association in the world to have such a section, responded saying simply, have you ever watched people making what we call euphemistically love? They puff, they pant, they grunt, they groan, etc. Could they be having fun?
And they get the same sort of endorphins.
And yeah, and if you can relate that, maybe in death and dying, what we see isn't the way that the person feels. Mm. And when you bring in the endorphins and the prostaglandins, so what? Those are the body's opiates. And let us remember, the body, in spite of being born, is also destined to die.
Yes. Well, we'll have to give the warning, don't try this at home.
Despite
sure. what Mike says about its possible advantages. However, it's a fascinating area. The problem is, of course, you can't do terribly many experiments on this sort of thing.
Well, there are experiments being done, right? At Southampton University, Southampton Hospital, there are experiments continuing right now, of which I became aware. But as soon as they realized I was an ex-journalist and a writer, they didn't want to have a thing to do with me. A major teaching hospital here in Sydney is doing similarly. And similarly, once they knew how I wanted to approach it, they didn't want to talk to me because of peer group pressures. I mean, if you allow your material to be published in a little book like Agostini's, you would lose all credibility. And I think they must ask the questions, what is going on?
Well, I must say, it's not quite that little. It's a very readable book. I was most impressed with the way you describe the influence of philosophers. Nietzsche, you've mentioned. Schopenhauer appears quite a lot.
Beautiful.
Jung and other authorities turn up. Lots of lovely stories. And presumably you're going to write a follow-up with the other 100 who've been in touch with you.
Absolutely. I plan to have, we're calling it right now, Death Book 2. And we don't know what else is going to come along, because one of these days, as you just said, we must warn people it's not something to try, and we're not endorsing killing yourself or anything of the sort. And of course, as you saw in the book, the reason why the Catholic Church gave up the ideas of reincarnation in 553 AD at the Second Council of Nice was because the Emperor Justinian became concerned because of the belief in reincarnation that was so rife and acceptable then, that people would do as they please and say, to hell with it, I've got another life to make up for whatever I do now. And it was banned. And I think that we have to be careful that this book doesn't set people off thinking that I can do as I please and I can come back and forth, because then we have to move into the realms of Buddhism and Catholicism and all of the strange things we have to go through, but that's a totally other story.
Absolutely, Mike, thank you very much. Music, what will you choose?
Island of the Sun, which is where I come from, the Caribbean.
Belafonte.
Belafonte.
Mike Agostini, thank you.
I hope the day will never come that I can't awake to the sound of drum. Never let me miss Carnival, the calypso songs full of sunny calm.
Harry Belafonte singing about Mike Agostini's first home, Island in the Sun. Mike's book, Death, the Ultimate Orgasm, is from Vaucluse Press. I'm Robin Williams.